Thank you. Okay, we're going to do a little meditation now called Appreciating Our Precious Human Life, which we're going to do with Sarah. This meditation can be quite an effective antidote to depression if we're getting very down about our life and our circumstances. We quite often, as I've already mentioned, tend to hone in on the negative side of our lives, and particularly of our own good qualities, probably, and of our own particular situation or predicament. I mean, obviously things aren't perfect by any means for any of us, but if we think about it, we are actually in an incredibly good position. The fact that we are all here together doing this, that we have the time and opportunity and inclination and ability to do that, is saying that in itself. I mean, not everybody has these chances, these opportunities, do they? There's just one qualifying thing I'd like to say about this practice. Part of it is thinking how our current position is particularly fortunate compared to a lot of other people and lots of other beings in the world. The only thing we have to be careful of is that we're not judging ourselves either here or here in relation to others. On the one hand, it certainly shouldn't make us feel that we're somehow better off or superior to others just because we're in a better position. I think that one goes without saying, but that's obviously something to be avoided. There's another danger. It could make us start feeling guilty about the fact that we get down about our problems at all because other people have problems so much worse than us. Again, that's something to be avoided. We all experience problems. We all get down sometimes. We all get down on ourselves. That's okay. We have to initially accept that to move and progress from that. And it's really, really important now. And again, it emphasizes what I was talking about earlier, is this importance of being gentle with yourself and realistic. I know I will keep banging on about that, but it really, really is so important, you know, when we're looking at this stuff. Okay, so I'll hand over to Sarah now.
Okay, so let's gently get back into nice, comfortable position where we can relax our body and our mind, and that any tensions just dissolve away, let them flow away. If it's just for now, we can have time for them later. So let's generate a positive, altruistic motivation for doing this meditation. You can think, for example, may this meditation bring greater peace and happiness to myself and others and to the whole world. Let's begin by contemplating that the nature of your mind is clear and pure and has the potential to develop a state of complete purity, goodness, and perfection. This is true for yourself, and this is true for all other beings. You can think, for example, the nature of every being's mind is clear like space, vast and unlimited. Our negative thoughts and emotions are not permanent. They're not fixed parts of our mind, but are transient, like clouds that pass through the sky. And because they are based on ignorance and misconceptions, they can be cleared away, and the mind can be developed to a state that is completely pure and positive. Alternatively, you can think of the positive qualities that you do have: intelligence, loving kindness, compassion, generosity, courage, and so forth. And remind yourself that these can be developed even further, and that you can use your life to bring benefit and happiness to others as well as yourself. Let's just spend a few moments contemplating this and really try and feel the joy about the potential that lies within you and all of us. Although all beings have the potential to transform their mind and become enlightened, not all beings are in the most ideal situation in which they can recognize and develop this potential. Imagine what it would be like as an animal, for example. Animals in the wild have no one to care for them when they experience hunger, thirst, heat, cold, sickness or injuries, and are in almost constant fear for their lives. Domestic animals are sometimes better off, but lack freedom and are often killed for meat, fur or other products. And all animals, even the most intelligent, have limited mental capacities and are unable to develop themselves intellectually or spiritually. Contemplate this to get a sense of how fortunate you are to have a human life. However, not all human beings have the right conditions to recognize and develop their potential. Imagine, for example, being a destitute beggar or living in a war zone. Most of your time and energy would be spent simply trying to keep yourself and your family alive. You would have little or no time to think of anything else, such as spiritual practice. Imagine suffering from a severe mental disability or illness, which would make it very difficult for you to understand the teachings on the mind's potential and how to develop it. Or having a physical condition that caused you a great deal of pain, discomfort and inconvenience and hindered your ability to learn and practice spiritual teaching. Some people do not have access to spiritual teachings that explain the mind's potential and how to develop it. Imagine spending your entire life in a small, remote village where there's no education or access to the world at large. No chance to meet the Dharma. Other people may be aware of their potential and sincerely wish to practice the teachings on how to develop it, but prevented from doing so by others. For example, some people in countries do not have freedom of religion or speech. Others face strong objections from their parents, spouse, or children. Imagine yourself in such a situation. Recognize how difficult it would be and appreciate the freedom that we have now. Then there are many people who are physically and mentally healthy and materially well off and have the freedom and opportunity to learn spiritual teachings, but are simply not interested. Their interests lie elsewhere, accumulating wealth perhaps, property and possessions, acquiring worldly knowledge or skills, or in simply experiencing as much pleasure as they can. They never consider that all these things will be left behind when they die, like a dream that vanishes as soon as we wake up. Some people engage in harmful actions, such as killing, stealing, being abusive or dishonest, not realizing that these actions cause suffering to themselves and others and create further obstacles to discovering their true potential. Try and recognize how fortunate you are to be interested in developing your potential and using your life in meaningful, beneficial ways for yourself and others. Now bring to mind the positive qualities and advantages you have. You are a human being with an intelligent mind, a loving heart, and a body you can put to good use. There are people who care about and support you. family, friends, a spiritual teacher, for example. You have opportunities to pursue your creative, intellectual, and social interests. You enjoy a good standard of living. At least you have enough to stay alive. And most of all, you have the potential and opportunity, because of all the other benefits, to investigate, understand, and transform your mind. Even if your life does not afford as much freedom and comfort as you would like, and even if you have to live with some very difficult problems and challenges, no matter where you are and what conditions you live in, you can always work on your mind. Think how few people or creatures on earth, in the past as well as the present, share these freedoms and chances with you. When you consider this deeply, you realise how rare and precious a life like yours is. Let's really try and feel and appreciate the good fortune. Once you have seen the disadvantages of your life is free of and the advantages that you do enjoy, decide how best to use your precious opportunities. Think of all the possibilities open to you. Normally, work, travel, enjoyment, study. If you wish to offer service to others, there are countless opportunities to help those less fortunate than yourself and develop yourself spiritually. Overcoming the negative aspects of your mind and increasing the positive and actualizing your potential for developing qualities like love, compassion, equanimity, and wisdom. Try to see the limitations of a lifestyle geared solely to materialistic gain. Think of the insignificance of fame, wealth, reputation, and sensual indulgence when compared to the goal of development. Why aspire to only temporal achievements when we are capable of so much more? See if you can feel a sense of joy and appreciation for the wonderful situation you have. Resolve to use your life wisely, doing your best to avoid harming others and instead helping them as much as you can and developing your love, compassion, wisdom, and other positive qualities that will enable you to actualize your highest potential. And finally, let's dedicate any energy and inspiration we've gained from doing this meditation to the ultimate happiness of all beings.
Thank you, Sarah. Okay, we're going to do some more discussion now. So again, Faye's going to split you up into breakout group. What I'm encouraging you to discuss this session is I talked in the last session about experiences we have of what's called sort of temporary cessation of suffering. You know, times when our mind is particularly peaceful, when we're relatively happy, obviously not really wanting for anything, and the importance of drawing inspiration from times and experiences like that. And I'm just encouraging you to share that with each other. And particularly then to talk about what it is that these experiences have in common and how they think they might be helping to inspire us and give us little pointers in what we can achieve in the long term through the overall transformation of our mind. Is that clear, or has anybody got any questions relating to that? Okay, I'll assume that's clear then. And again, I remember this time. I mean, obviously, Elizabeth has already addressed some of this in those interesting comments in the last session, which is very, very relevant to this discussion. So, again, can one person just take responsibility for taking a few notes and feeding back? And then we'll encourage everybody to speak if they want to as well, but it's helpful. Yes, Elizabeth.
Sorry, it's not clear for me.
Right.
No, I apologize. If it's clear for everybody, then somebody in the group can tell me.
Well, it's kind of what you were talking about, actually, a short while ago when I went to the loo.
Mm-hmm.
But to discuss times when our mind is particularly calm,
okay,
particularly peaceful, and particularly happy, not in a graspy sort of way, in a calm, happy kind of way, to share experiences of that. And it can be absolutely anything. As I say, people get this in different ways. You know, we mentioned a jigsaw puzzle. Some people it can be doing sports. Some people it can be through nature. It's a starlight sky and things like that. And some people it can be through meditation. So just share those kind of experiences and how you think we can actually draw inspiration from these times in a way that can affect our long-term spiritual development. Yeah, is that clear? Okay. And again, we'll type it up a bit and we'll post that through Faye halfway through your discussion, just to remind you.
The question was, share times when you feel particularly happy and peaceful. What inspiration can we draw from these for our long-term spiritual development? What do these experiences have in common?
Right, welcome back, everyone. Okay, group one. Did you pick a person to feedback?
Were we in group one? I got him, yeah.
Do you want to...
Sorry.
<Yeah.
laughs> No idea.
I've got no idea either, Zoe. Yeah, you're in good company.
Well, also the,
after you, Zoe, yeah, feedback.
Yeah, I was with like Toral and Dana and Rachel, and
right,
we kind of were very similar. We're talking about being at peace in nature. So Rachel was talking about being at the beach in Northumberland, which is absolutely gorgeous. Toral was also talking about the sea and nature, and a time when she went for a coffee and she just had a moment of peace having that coffee and just chillaxing. I was saying about being on the side of Cat Bells in the Lake District, which is my favourite place in the whole universe. And Jana was saying about, because she's a gypsy at heart and travels, and she was saying about going, packing a rucksack and thinking about their next adventure and finding peace in that. Tara said something really, really good. It was so good, I wrote it down. She's talking about being nature and the sound of waves, and she just said nature reminds us of impermanence. I just thought that was brilliant, and I wanted to share that with everybody.
Yeah.
And then talked about taking that little piece of happiness, piece with you, and I mentioned about going at work sitting on the loo, and that's the only time to sit there and feel like try and find that little bit of peace. So, and then
I do a lot of meditating on the loo, yeah.
Yeah, and then the conversation just went down to, you know, the toilet. So, yeah, my husband's very proud that I managed to bring the conversation down to the toilet. Yeah, it was really, really good.
Great. Some great points there. I love the connection with nature and impermanence. It's interesting as well, talking about travelling, because we've done a fair bit of that and backpacking, and you do kind of get into the habit of going with the flow, I think, a lot more when you're travelling. That you don't have all the same kinds of sort of attachments and things that we tend to cling to when we're at home, and I think that can be interesting. It's that was my experience anyway. But thanks. I mean, that was tremendous. That was very inspiring, actually. How about the other group? Who've we got in the other group?
The other group, that it's Susan and Elizabeth, isn't it?
I think we forgot to choose a spokesperson.
Who wants to go
there? I'll say something.
Right, okay, Claire.
We talked a bit about nature, but not quite as much as the other group. And we also talked about some other things, such as listening to the radio, maybe, when you can't do much else. And also things like craft and art and things. But how that can actually lead to grasping an ego if you're not careful. And that's something I found myself, that I was buying more and trying to do more and more things, and then to just cut it down and to get something really simple and easy and that anybody can do. Just something, diamond painting, which is a bit like a jigsaw, but with tiny squares like mosaic. Most people think it's not art, but it's great. It takes you into that really quiet place. And I find that I can think about the Dharma and have a mind that it's much calmer by doing that. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't know if anybody else wants to say anything from our group.
Susan?
About the grasping, I think sometimes for me, if I feel if I do more, I'm going to get enlightened quicker, or I'm going to feel better quicker because if I do more courses. If I do more of something, I'm going to get somewhere quicker. And basically it just confuses my mind, and it gets all confused because it hasn't got a chance to calm down, because you're always looking for the next something else out there, I think, instead of coming back inside and thinking. Sometimes too many activities can actually hinder, because you just become self-seek, like looking outside for gratification all the time. That's how I see it.
Important point, that. Yeah, it does. And again, it's getting the right balance, isn't it? Things like courses, reading, taking on new stuff can be enormously helpful. But you're absolutely right. That can start becoming a habit in itself, just chasing things. I think that's a really, really good point. A lot of people have talked about nature, and I must say I personally find nature particularly inspiring. Not only the impermanence as well, I talked about how everything exists interdependently, which is very much part of understanding emptiness, and how we're all part of that interdependent flow, if you like. I must say, personally, I get some of my strongest feelings for that when I'm in nature, either day or night. I find it when I look at the stars sometimes, I get a strong sense of that. How about, what inspiration do you think we can draw from these experiences in terms of our spiritual practice? What do people think?
I think It's just to stop, just to be here now, which is my saving grace, just to stop and just be here now. And then you get that mental image of that place, and you draw it into yourself, and you're just there, and you just stop.
I think as well, I agree, Zoe, I think that's very well put. I thought also Elizabeth was getting it this earlier, and when I nipped out to the loo in the last session, when she was talking with Sarah. I think one thing that a lot of these experiences have in common, and do please pipe up if people disagree, is that when we're having these experiences, our attention is very, very much in the present moment. And Elizabeth talked about that, didn't she, at the early session. Relating that to these three poisons, the attachment and aversion have kind of temporarily subsided. I mean, attachment is all about always trying to move towards something else. Aversion is about always trying to pull away from something. And when we're having those kind of experiences, that's kind of, at least the grosser levels of that have subsided. Now, that is partly why Shinne meditation, that calm-abiding meditation I've been talking about, can bring incredible feelings of peace and eventually bliss as well, if it's really, really persevered with. And again, because it makes the attachment and aversion stop for a while. You know, they're not activating anymore. So that's not triggering all the other problematic stuff on the surface. Yeah, and it comes with a feeling of contentment. It is very important, though, from a Buddhist point of view, that on its own, that isn't enough. It won't lead to really, really lasting peace and satisfaction. It will still have a very, very beneficial effect on your mind. There's no question of that. And it's why people find mindfulness so effective. But it has to be combined eventually from a Buddhist point of view with that understanding of the empty and interdependent nature. So which then will make these experiences less fleeting. It'll be something that we can apply much more as we're, if you like, moving around and interacting with the world at large and dealing with problems. But is there anything else anybody else wants to raise in relation to that?
I mean, we all talked about what makes us actually focus at that moment, either meditation, art and craft, having a bath with essential oils. It's as well stimulating our senses. But so, yeah, going back to slowing down and concentrating on one thing at that moment. Talking about travels, which I mentioned when we were in the first group as well, when I was traveling, at least when I could, I realized, you know, when you were meeting people, you know, you just have to enjoy that moment, because you know that a moment after that, whoever will have gone their way, you're their way, so you meet, and so forth, and being in a travel, if depending, it will bring that as well, that encounter, that it's not, how to say that, impermanence, yeah, in a way,
yeah,
of the moment, and it could bring that as well. It's a great experience, because you're here, this is happening, and then you're somewhere else. So traveling is a great way as well to achieve that when it's possible.
Yeah, I think a lot of us have found it's helpful in lots of ways like that, yeah.
It's great.
That can become almost like an addiction if we're not careful as well, can't it? And just putting the other side, and it's... but no, I agree very, very much. And certainly Sarah and I have drawn a lot of inspiration from that over the past. I agree.
Martin, could I just ask?
Yes, who's that?
It's Rachel.
I just apologise, Rachel. I can't see
you.
No,
it's okay. No, sorry, I'm sort of ducking in and out. The just asking, you know, obviously we talk about being in the moment, and we can find that period of time, be it in nature or whatever, to find that sort of calm. But I guess, and you sort of touched on there, that actually it's only sort of for a period of time, because then obviously you need something else to go alongside that. But it's kind of, I've got to, I'm trying to explain myself. So if we then get, if we then go come out of that and we go back into sort of real life stuff, but you know what I mean, that the normal sort of day-to-day stuff when we're not in the moment, is the intention that the more we get into that moment, that we're getting into a better state of mind that will help us with the other stuff on the outside? Or what's the understanding of how that's going to work? Because obviously we can get into these moments of of calm and feeling great and feeling at peace, but then we've got to go back to the real world, I suppose, is the best other way to explain it. And then how do we, is the idea what we draw from that that then helps us in the real world situation once we're back in that?
Thanks, that's all very well put, actually. It will definitely affect and bring some benefit. If we can calm down our minds sometimes and get more concentrated, it will affect in a beneficial way what comes later. And I think most of us experience that. It's why it's good to do a little bit of calm abiding meditation at the start of the day or before we do any other activity. Mm-hmm. However, as you rightly say, to some extent, the effects of that will wear off. When we start encountering problems and interacting the world at large. This is why, from a Buddhist point of view, it's so important to bring that empty, the emptiness, interdependence side into it. And if we can conjoin those two, eventually that will get to a point where it really will be much more lasting, and that effect. And it will affect us, and we'll be much, much less vulnerable then to being adversely affected, you know, as problems come. It's why it's Buddhism's really, really strong on this, and it's why I keep relating it back to calm abiding meditation, because it's the same principle. I mean, if you do a jigsaw and you keep your mind very focused on what you're doing, there are quite similar things happening than if you're meditating on the breath, really. And some of you, I think, have articulated that, you know, very clearly, aren't they? So it is still enormously beneficial, and it is important to draw inspiration from that and use it effectively, the kind of mental clarity and concentration that comes as a result of that practice. But it's not enough on its own. It's not enough on its own. And it's why it's so important to combine it with the other aspects of the path, which basically we can divide between wisdom and love and compassion. Yeah, it's so important. But if we bring those things in as well, mm-hmm. then eventually it can have that much more lasting effect on all our interactions with the world at large. Does that answer what you were getting at, Rachel?
Yes, thank you. Yeah, that's great.
There's some good questions there. That's great. Right, does anybody else want to say anything? It doesn't have to be a question if you just want to share anything.
Yes, I do, if possible. Can you hear me, Martin?
Yes, I can. Sorry, Claire. Yes.
Yeah, I just wanted to mention about time, but in as much as it's good to perhaps sometimes have some sort of routine each day, so that if you're doing something that you know makes you in that place, then you have a time to do it. And it seems as though that actually helps to imprint the mind to be able to work with the body at a certain time.
Yeah, I think you're right. It's something people have had lots of opportunities to work with over the last year, I think, a lot of people, this, isn't it?
Yeah.
And all of a sudden, the whole daily routine has changed. And I agree very much. I mean, I'll talk about it in relation to meditation, but it could be in relation to other activities that produce the same kind of benefits. And I think we're very, very habitual anyway, our minds, I think, aren't we? And that's both for good and for bad. Yeah. And again, a lot of practice is trying to reduce bad habits and develop good ones. But with meditation, I think it's really important to try and make it a regular thing, getting into that habit. And this the same would apply with other activities that are good for you. I mean, in our place, going for walks is something we factor into our day every day. It's important. It's one reason why at the start of today, one thing I said is when you're setting up a meditation practice, when we're doing the breathing, start small. It's really important, this, I think. 5 minutes a day, just at the start of your day. But really, really try and stick to it. You will find gradually, because that becomes the habit then, it almost becomes harder not doing it most days. And you can then build on that gradually. There is a danger, what a lot of people do, and we all got very, very enthused, a bit like what Susan was hinting at, where we just keep doing one course after another things. We get enormously enthused. I did when I started. And I thought I was going to sit and do calm abiding meditation for an hour and a half every day. And that lasted for a week, maybe. I'm closer to that now, but the reason for that is because I then reined back a bit and just started doing 5 minutes. And then 5 minutes became 10 minutes and 10 minutes became 15 minutes and so on. And again, it's working skillfully with that habitual tendency of the mind. So that's what I think what you said related to meditation, but as you say, it applies to lots of other things as well. I think that's very, very important. Is there anything else anybody else wants to ask? Or
can I just say, Chandra Rinpoche, Lama, she's down, I think she goes to see visit down in the place in Wales. She once said that with meditation, it's the quality, not the quantity. So she said, so you get people who go, well, I meditate every day for an hour, but if it's not quality, if it's not good, if it's just you sitting in quietly and but not actually meditating, it's just not worth the point of doing it. So she said the similar thing. It's like, because people dive in, don't they? They said to me, I tried meditating, so I sat there and thought, right now I'm going to try and think of nothing. And then they get disheartened and then they don't, and they just give up on it. But yeah, I just thought I'd share that about Chandra Rinpoche.
No, and what you've brought in there, Zoe, which I didn't talk about, is the quality rather than the quantity. And I agree very, very much. And particularly when we're doing calm abiding meditation, what you realise when you start doing that is that actually subduing your mind to that extent is very, very difficult. And again, this comes back to being realistic. The first step is to notice that your mind tends to fly off here and fly off there very, very readily. If you can, it's easier to really focus on doing it properly for a few minutes. And again, it's very important you don't force it. You'll find some days it comes more easily than others. And that can be interesting in itself if you see, you know, what you're particularly distracted with and why it's so difficult. But if you just do it for a few minutes, the quality is likely to be much, much better, again, without forcing it. And then a month later, you could maybe just stretch that by a couple of minutes and so on and so on and so on. And you're absolutely right. And that makes the quality much, 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 much more effective. Really good point. Really good point. And thanks for sharing that. Is there anything else anybody wants to share?
Tora, yeah. And then Elizabeth after Tora.
I don't know, like this is kind of a different thing and maybe we'll talk about it tomorrow or something. I'm just thinking about the kind of psychology aspect here and that negative critical voice in your head that's kind of always sabotaging you or, you know, telling you that. So even if sometimes if I am in a peaceful moment, there's that kind of voice that's like, yeah, but, you know, it won't last, or yeah, but you've got this problem. So I don't know, like maybe at some stage I would be interested to hear your thoughts on the negative voice that we have in our minds that's kind of seems like it's like, you know, always out to get us or kind of bring us down. And just kind of how we can, the Buddhist practice can, you know, kind of deal with that voice, I guess.
I think I could certainly relate to what you're saying, and I'll be surprised if everybody else doesn't as well. We all have that. We all have that, don't we? And it is an obstacle. Sometimes it's not always bad either, though, is it? It could actually be encouraging us to improve and to change as well. And again, it's a question of getting the balance right, but that will only happen very, very, very gradually. I think it's important. And again, a lot of the thing with that is stepping back and giving yourself a break, I think. Particularly what we often find is we're a lot harder on ourselves than we are on other people. Yeah. And we apply much streaks to Sanders, really, to judging ourselves. And that we're things that, to be honest, we're quite accepting of in the people around us. And do you agree with that? I think that's true, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah.
And it's good to remind ourselves of that sometimes. But you have to, again, it's changing your habit. You have to, if you're noticing that you're starting to beat yourself up. One thing I'm going to talk about tomorrow is the distinction between regret and guilt, in a Buddhist point of view. Regret, generally, and again, we're dealing with translations of words, so I have to, because sometimes we use those words interchangeably. But in terms of thinking, no, I could have done that better, I'd like to do that better in the future, that's a good thing from a Buddhist point of view. But what it can very easily become is start to get wrapped up again around this very solid sense of me and I that I've talked about, which is really ignorance, you know, it's not, the I doesn't exist that solidly. And that, oh God, I'm a crappy person, I deserve to suffer, I'm so useless, I'm so powerless. Once it starts creeping into that, it can be very, very negative. And that's what normally we talk about as a guilt. in a Buddhist context, which is considered really very harmful. But actually addressing that, again, it's a gradual thing. It won't suddenly happen. There's no sort of magic solution for that. But as you come to understand yourself better, your relationship to reality and other people better, as you come to appreciate and nurture more your good qualities, that will get easier. That will get easier, I think. That's been my experience a little bit in my life. But I can certainly relate very much to what you say. I think we all have that. And sometimes it's okay to listen to it as well. I mean, we just have to look at it honestly, I think.
Yeah, I think because I think it comes from fear, doesn't it? It's like it's trying to protect you all the time, isn't it? Like, yeah. So, but it just goes too far sometimes. So, yeah.
Absolutely. And as you say, that's often described as one of the manifestations of this very conquering notion of I, this deluded notion of I, that's always trying to protect itself. And sometimes to the exclusion of others, and that's then a problem. That's again very, very much linked to ignorance, but it's only something we can change very, very gradually over time.
I wonder sometimes, like, my ego is, oh well, I've gloated, I've been pleased about myself with that today, exhausted that, oh I better start wallowing, you know what I mean? Because I'm still the star of the show, aren't I? Oh, how terrible I was, and if only I'd done that better, and why can't I do you know what I mean? I'm not helping anybody else while I'm doing that, certainly, and I'm still extremely prominent in my own thoughts.
Oh yeah, it's all about me in that moment. Yeah
So sometimes I think it's just your ego wanting to, you know, be in the front.
Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah. Okay, is there anything else?
Can I just, I said before when I was in our group that I'm a nurse, but I'm an artist as well, and I've got a bit of an obsession. So while we've been talking, I've actually done something for Tara. I don't know if you can see it.
Oh, wow.
Can you see it? Wow. I don't know if it's backwards.
That's beautiful.
Wow, it's only nice. Like a quickie, but... yeah, it just isn't. I just love what she said about nature reminds of us impermanence. So it's only a quick sketch, but
that's fantastic.
That's fantastic. Thank you very much.
I think I might do a bigger piece and stuff. I'm getting all sorts of ideas. But if Tal, if you want this,
I do.
Yeah,
you'll want it.
That's lovely.
I'll figure it out with emails and stuff, and then you know I can send it to you.
Yeah, okay, we'll exchange emails because that's beautiful. Thanks.
Oh, thank you.
Maybe Faye could put it up on the Land of Joy,
because normally when we do retreats live, we do all share emails on the retreat. Obviously it's not obligatory, so people choose.
You can all have my email, honestly. You, as soon as this COVID's done, you're all coming for tea, honestly. You're all going to come to tea. We've got a big enough garden, we can get a bit of a festival going. You're all coming to.
And likewise with Faye, I'm sure we could discuss this. It'd be really nice to do that for people who want to, so we can have a sharing of emails, because it can be quite nice afterwards to carry on a bit the spirit of the course of the retreat. But shall we have a chat about that, Faye, later, if there's a most practical way of doing that? I think that's great. Right, just to wrap that little bit up, I'm going to talk again for a short while now, and then we're going to finish with a bit more meditation today. It is really good to draw inspiration from these kinds of experiences. I mean, I've talked about how it relates, or that can get a bit headier, how it relates to subduing attachment and aversion. But it's inspiring and it's really, really important. One of the things I talked about in the start, when we talk about the Four Noble Truths and the truth of suffering, it certainly doesn't mean we're miserable all the time or that we shouldn't take pleasure in things. It's very, very important that we do. And obviously, we take a lot of pleasure in our lives, and the kinds of experiences we've been talking about can be particularly inspiring. And it does give a clue that we are capable of happiness. We are capable of peace. It is there in us. It's something that's waiting to be actualized. The only proviso, I'm sorry to finish on a negative note, but it's without clinging to them, of course. But I think you've all already been discussing that and addressing that. If we start clinging to these experiences and chasing them, that can then become a problem in itself. And I think of people have expressed a lot of this is about just being, isn't it? You know, not doing that. But thank you. I thought that was a cracking discussion. I really enjoyed that. I just want to talk, before we do the final meditation, just a little bit about what we mean by mind. I've been using the term mind and transforming our mind and exactly what it means in Buddhism. when we talk about mind and the nature of mind. Now, the first thing I think it's important to be clear on is when we say mind in Buddhism, we're not talking about the physical brain or other physiological states. The definition of mind from a Buddhist point of view is clarity and awareness. That's what's it's clear and knowing. That's the definition. It's that clear subjective experience of consciousness that we are all experiencing right now as we're sitting here being aware. Yeah. It is our minds and our states of consciousness are intimately connected to physiological states, which includes the brain. There's no question of that, and there's lots of evidence of that, obviously. But they're not one and the same thing. They're interdependent, but they're not one and the same thing. And it's quite good to be clear on that. I don't want to make generalizations about the fields of neuroscience, because there are actually lots of different views within the fields of neuroscience. But there has traditionally been a kind of presumption of the primacy of matter, I think, quite often in the Western approach to this. That is changing, and it's definitely changing that. From a Buddhist point of view, that's not quite right. And mind and matter are seen as being interdependent, with neither one of them having primacy. Yeah. Now, to give some examples of this, there's some really, really interesting research on this, and I would encourage people to Google these. I find some of the work done by Professor Richard Davidson, for instance, at the University of Wisconsin on neuroplasticity and the effects of meditation actually has on the pathways and things in the brain, are fascinating, very affirming of this. We all know that our mind is affected by the brain and physiological states. I mean, obviously, if we take drugs or intoxicants, if you have certain types of surgery or injuries, there's no question of that. No question of that. So in that sense, mind is affected by the physical. However, that's not only in that direction. And this is where some of the research in neuroplasticity is so interesting. Actually, just doing practices like meditation, or just practices like kindness and altruism, actually have an effect on the physical brain. And there's lots of evidence emerging for that now. And that's what we talk about, neuroplasticity. As I say, and Richard Davidson is particularly, with the encouragement of his elders, the Dalai Lama, actually done research on meditators. And some of that work is actually very, very affirming and inspiring. I mean, one of his stated aims is to try and produce objective evidence for the benefits of meditation, which our culture is quite strong on, of course, isn't it? And to hopefully eventually argue it should be taught in schools and school curriculum and so on. But that is very much ongoing, that stuff. And again, this relationship between mind and matter is two-way. I think that's quite important. But when we're talking about mind in Buddhism, we're talking about the clear non-material side of consciousness. Which we all experience, as I say, we're experiencing it right now. Another thing I think to be clear on is, again, when we say mind, sometimes in English, that we might just think of the intellect. You know, we talk about somebody having a great mind, we normally mean they're very clever. We don't necessarily mean that they're very kind. But when we talk about mind in Buddhism, it's including emotions and feelings as well. A synonym for mind is consciousness. And that includes all our emotional states. Again, there is a tendency sometimes in the way we talk about, for instance, thoughts and feelings in English, to talk about them almost as two separate bundles. You know, one thing we deal with thoughts, another time we deal with feelings. That's not how Buddhist psychology looks at it. And any given cognitive event has these different elements, what's sometimes called mental factors. There's always what's called a main mind underneath, which is that basic awareness, but that is coloured by what are called mental factors. Some of these are neither wholesome nor unwholesome, they're neutral, and they can be either, depending how they're used. There are some, for instance, which are called the always present ones, which includes intention, attention, discrimination, things like that. It's just, they're practical ways that our mind operates, just to interact and function at all and interact with the world. And they can be used either positively or negatively. And one of those omnipresent ones is feeling. Yeah. So, which is where the emotional component comes in, and that's always present. It can be more or less strong. It can be neutral, but every cognitive event has these different elements. Yeah. So when I say mind, it's a very, very broad concept again, and it just means consciousness and awareness. And very importantly, it very much includes feelings, which is the main point I wanted to get across there. Now, again, I've introduced there the idea of mental factors, some of which are neither wholesome nor unwholesome. And as I say, it depends on the situation. There are certain ones, however, that in Buddhism are described as unwholesome, and certain ones that are described as wholesome. And we're going to be looking at this more specifically tomorrow, and particularly how to deal with reducing the unwholesome and nurturing the wholesome ones. But again, the basic rule here, and it's important we don't get this mixed up with sort of ideas of judgment and evil and things like this. It's a very practical description. Wholesome ones are those that are rooted in wisdom and compassion and that lead to more happiness and a decrease of suffering for self and others. Unwholesome ones are the opposite. They're aligned with ignorance, i.e. with that sense of separation between self and other that I've talked about with. And I think we can feel that, as I'll use the example of anger, which really makes us feel very separate from others, you know, and with this very strong sense of a me here that needs defending. And they lead to problems and difficulties for oneself and others. So that's the guiding principle with that. There are traditional lists, and we'll look at some of that tomorrow. But they're not complete. We could probably always think of extra ones we might add ourselves, and some will resonate more than others. But that's good to keep that as a guiding principle. Are there any questions on that before I move on to the next bit? Okay.
Okay,
is that okay? Right, that's clear. Okay.
Thank you, Faye. Sorry, I've just wanted to say something relating to what we just spoke about. First of all, there is hope. I completely understand where you're going through. You could maybe have a look at the Land of Joy website and the resources on self-compassion. There has been a course earlier this month. And there's meditation, and that might be helpful. And as far as the I is, you know, the I is kind of separate. If that little voice will stop at some point, so trust me, it should. I mean, it comes back, obviously, but you'll be more able to. And then I'm the first one to meditate at the end of the day, like when, you know, it's dark, there's nothing else to do, and starting in the morning. So I'll have to think about that habit.
Yeah, I think everybody has to find their own way with that. I mean, more
time,
right, if you've got the time, but some people find it comes more easily in the morning, some in the evening, and you have to work with that.
Yeah, but the time, finding the time.
And it helps set the stall out for the rest of the day.
Coming back to,
and also the evening sessions for me are equally important in a different kind of way. So it's ideally if you can do both, that's great. But not everybody has the same amount of time.
Yeah, to wind down in the evening. But to come back to Rachel's comment, I mean, obviously during the group we talked about specific action that make us think about the now. But please correct me if I am incorrect. I think the Buddhist point of view, but I'm not a specialist at all, is that every action that we are focused in what we are doing. You know, everything on a daily basis, you know, that you're driving, that you're washing up, that you're dealing with your bills, that you're working. You do it in, some people will talk about mindfulness on a focused, with the intention and the attention and the intention and in a mindfulness manner. So, which is actually the idea to do that, if possible, all the time, not only when we are doing art and craft or walking in nature or jigsawing.
That's absolutely right. And that is the mindfulness part of the Noble Eightfold Path that I described earlier. But that's totally right, what you just said. It definitely is.
So reminding to do that all the time, which,
again comes and goes. Again, we have to be realistic, don't we? Yes, Susan, you've got to
have it. Just a quick one, I know, go. It's when you're saying that mindfulness to concentrate on one task at a time. But I think, just speak from a woman's point of view, we were taught to multitask, to be doing so many things in one go. So you'd be, you know, you're cooking, but then you're doing some, I've done that, I'm brushing my teeth, but I'm doing some, I'm cooking and then I'm doing all these different things instead of just doing one thing at that moment and let it finish and then go on to the next one. But and it was, we were told, I thought that multitasking is really, really good because that's clever.
Sometimes it is. And also mindfulness doesn't only mean doing one thing at a time.
Isn't that right?
It's okay. Broader as well. Sometimes you have to be doing more than one thing at a time. And mindfulness isn't just about that. It's being aware of what's going on around you, but also very, very importantly, what's going on in your inner world and how you're reacting to things. Because it's through that we can actually really start to understand our mind and its strengths and weaknesses, and we can start to really work with it in a productive way. So it isn't just doing one thing at a time in the sense like we do when we meditate on our breathing or if we're doing a jigsaw puzzle. I mean, Thich Nhat Hanh talks a lot about being mindful when we're washing up, doesn't he? But you can still apply mindfulness even when you're multitasking. It's being more aware rather than just, if you like, going around like a robot, not really being very aware of what you're doing. Okay, well, I'll tell you, we've only got 10 minutes or so left. I'm going to do a meditation, but this kind of concludes the other thing I was going to talk about today. So can we get ourselves nice and comfy? And again, think about what I said earlier about just checking your posture. I'm not going to go through it. But the important thing is you're nice and comfy. And that your back's nice and straight. In a nice, relaxed way, though. Don't force anything. And we're going to do a meditation on the clarity of the mind. And then finally conclude that with a little bit of a reflection on emptiness and interdependence, which is something I've talked about already today. Before we start the practice, one thing that's considered very important, again, from a Buddhist point of view, that it's at deepest level, our mind is essentially pure and clear. None of the afflictive or troublesome mental states we experience are totally integrated with the mind. The mind's often compared to a clear blue sky. The afflictions come and go like clouds, lacking any real substance. But always underneath that is the clear blue sky. And this is actually related to something called Buddha nature, which is our potential to become enlightened, which every one of us has at the deepest level of our being. No exceptions to that. And at the moment, the afflictions are obscuring it. But it is there. It's not something that has to be created anew. It's there already at the deepest level of our being. The meditation we're going to do now, and again, this can be quite tricky, so don't expect too much. The first part is another type of stabilizing meditation, a bit like what we do on the breath. But we're going to take the mind itself and the clarity as the object to focus on. And in the long run, this can get us more in touch with that essentially clear, pure nature. But even in the short term, this could really break our kind of clinging and very concrete projections of things as being more solid and real than they really are. So the first thing we're going to do is turn our attention, and just as we did at the start of today, to the natural rhythms of our breathing. And with this practice, it can be quite difficult getting the objects. If you find your mind's getting very diffused, it's just good just to go back to the breathing for a little bit. Just calm down the mind and settle down. Notice those natural rhythms as you breathe. Ebb and flow of your breathing, all the subtle sensations. Now turn your attention to your mind, to your consciousness, your awareness. Which all your experiences are reflected, like reflections in a mirror. Just as trees, cars, houses arise within space, all our thoughts, feelings, mental images, memories, projections of the future, all these things arise within the space of the mind. The mind is like a clear blue sky. Thoughts and feelings come and go like clouds, ultimately lacking any real substance, and then just dissolve back into the space of the mind. We'll just try and sit with that for a couple of minutes. And again, you're just sitting with that experience. Try not to think. The mind's clarity of that basic awareness. Clear, expansive nature. And when distractions come, don't worry about it. Don't try and force them away. Just let them come and go very naturally. And like clouds. They dissolve back into the sky of the night. These little visualizations I'm going to do are just to help with this. Not the main point of the meditation. Again, it's just to sit with that feeling of the mind, clear, spacious. Expansive. So imagine that you're looking up at a clear blue sky. That clear blue sky comes down and totally envelops you and your surroundings. Try and feel that the essential nature of your mind is vast, unobstructed. Like the clear blue sky. Mind is like the sun, radiant, illuminating everything around it. Try not to think too much, just be the radiant, luminous sun. Just be the clear blue sky. If this practice is totally new to you, getting the object initially can be quite difficult, as I say, much more than with the breath. The object's very obvious. So the mind's clarity is a little bit more ephemeral than that. And if you're finding that and your mind's going all over the place again, just return back to your breathing for a bit, just to settle. As I said at the start, it is worth persevering with this practice. Get us more in touch with more subtle levels of the mind. That essential clarity that I've talked about. We can break off very concrete projections of things and events, which can be quite helpful in reducing problems. As with all this, we mustn't expect too much too quickly. Now, just to conclude this practice, we've only got so much time in this session. I'm now going to move on to what really is the second type of meditation. As I talked at the start, there are two real types of meditation. One is calmizing, stabilizing meditation, like will and the breathing, which is the first part of this practice. We're just taking the mind's clarity as the object. Second type of meditation is sometimes called analytical meditations, but that can be a bit misleading because it includes meditations on developing love and compassion and things like that, which we'll be doing tomorrow. It includes that meditation Sarah did earlier, the precious human life. Now we're just going to reflect a little bit on the mind's emptiness. Mind, just like every other phenomenon in existence, is empty of independent, substantial, inherent existence. But emptiness doesn't mean that things don't exist, it just means they exist interdependently in the flow of cause and effect, which we're all a part. Our mind is no exception to that. First of all, mind or consciousness needs an object. Awareness needs something to be aware of. Even in this case, where the object is the mind's clarity, no thought. Also, mind is subject to subtle impermanence, which we've already looked at, and this is related as well to its emptiness. It's often compared to a river or a stream flowing through time. Each moment leads to the next, to the next, to the next, and so on. But if we actually try to catch or find a moment of mind, we can't really find one. However much we break down that continuity, however small we break it down into moments, each moment will have a beginning, middle, and an end. If we break it down further, we'll still find the same ad infinitum. There aren't any moments of mind to be ultimately to be found. There's just that flow through time. Clearly, mind exists. We're aware, we're experiencing it right now. It exists interdependently in relation to the rest of reality, like everything else. We can reflect on the mind, that the way our mind is constantly being affected by our surroundings, people around us. And in turn, our mind, which is, of course, influences our words and our actions. It's effective with influencing the people around us. We've all affected each other's minds just by being present the last 3 hours this morning. Just try just to conclude the practice to get a feeling of how our minds are as much a part of that interdependent flow of cause and effect as everything else. Really try and get a sense of that connection, particularly with other beings. We all know the expression, no one is an island. Nothing could be more true. Finally, just to conclude this morning, we're going to do a little dedication. Just as it's always good to start out before we do anything with a good motivation. From the point of view of karma, it's good, particularly when we've done something that's positive or wholesome, to get a feeling of satisfaction at the end of that activity. Very important we rejoice in positive actions. And everyone could have done other things this morning, that's some of which would have been a lot easier. We could have just stayed in bed. Now it's taken effort to join in with this, to contribute, which everybody has, right now. Just by being here. Then give yourself a little bit of credit for that. Then think how any benefit that's come either to yourself or in helping others. In the smallest extent, I mean, the workings out of cause and effects are very, very subtle. Tiny positive actions can actually produce really powerful results. All the workings of cause and effect. Let's wish that that contributes to the long-term benefit and welfare of all sentient beings. Okay, right, we've gone 10 minutes over time, which I partly apologise for. That is a bit me, I'm afraid. I'm a bit prone to do that. I hope that hasn't caused problems for anyone.